Tim Murdoch. You're watching Endgame Exotica, which is an exclusive interview series to White Rabbit Radio. And today we have on a first-time guest, Mr. Sam Milia. Did I pronounce it correctly, Sam Milia?
You did, yes. Thank you.
And he is from the United Kingdom, and he has an interesting story. We know of him through Patriotic Alternative and our good friend Mark Collette. He went to jail for being white and putting out stickers in the United Kingdom. Would you put it any other way?
No, that's pretty much the long and short of it. Yeah,
it's so silly. You got to laugh. I don't know if anyone would actually believe it if you didn't know, like, it was in the BBC and stuff like that. You know.
It's you'd expect something a lot more nefarious, but it was literally stickers, and they admitted as well that the stickers themselves weren't actually the problem. It was my hidden intent behind them. And that's what. They're like, all right, okay.
You can't, here's the thing. There's no such thing as like innocent. What is it?
Innocent until proven guilty.
Truth is not a defense, right? There's no such thing as truth is not a defense in these types of cases. It's like they get to read your mind.
Yeah, and that was all despite so much of the evidence they presented was me talking to personal friends and after in DMs saying like, yeah, I've done this, you know, so that it's within the law and I don't intend to incite racial hatred or all this kind of stuff, you know, situations in which I'd have no reason to lie if I had some ulterior motive. Yet it was all inferred by very limited evidence, really. Do you want me to move my camera? So
no, you're okay. You're totally all
right. You're all right.
You're all right. Yeah. I got you all dialed in. Cool. But it's so silly. I don't. When did you actually end up getting involved in this type of right wing politics in the UK? How long have you known Mark? Give us some background because he's been on the show many times. And how did you come into the Patriotic Alternative? You give us an overview.
Yeah, my entry into the political sphere was way back in, when was Gamergate? Was that like 2013?
Yeah, it was before the rise of Trump, 2013, yeah, yeah. 2014, I think, yes.
Yeah, so it's like that opened me up to basically the wider political sphere on the internet. Okay. Because prior to that. Yeah. Still am in a way. Okay. But really it was just finding the coverage and then the kind of the other stuff that the people covering the Gamergate thing were also talking about. And then from there, more reading, watching more things. And before you knew it, I was looking to get active. I'd just been kind of disengaged up to that point. And then very quickly you kind of come across the grooming gang issue here in the UK and that really hit home for me. The kind of horrors that these girls have been through. And I decided like, all right, I'm going to try and get active a bit more. And it was around the rise of Trump. There was a bit more energy here in the UK as well. And, attended a few meetings, went to a demonstration and everything, but nothing really fit with me. And then when Trump had his kind of meteoric shot for the presidency the first time, all the censorship happened. So you had people losing YouTube channels, Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts and everything. And my idea was to basically take a lot of the rhetoric that they'd been putting out there, and if we were going to have the internet denied to us, then I'd take it to the streets with a kind of guerrilla propaganda campaign, which is where the stickers came about. And knowing that the UK has very stringent speech laws, I knew I had to control it completely. There'd be no way I'd be able to allow this into the hands of literally anyone because, well, anyone, you know, whether nefarious or well-meaning, could potentially spin it and it would blow back on me. So the way we organized it was I was the head. I was the only outlet for these stickers. I'd design them. I'd publish them myself. People could suggest things to me, and, you know, hundreds did. And then each sticker also had a number as well, and it could be referred back to like a hard copy. And once published, they weren't changed. so that should, you know, something bad happen, you know, a real kind of, someone put out a sticker attributed to me with some really wild kind of stuff on it, I could say, well, you know, that's supposed to be number 170. Number 170 is actually, you know, this other one. And generally, I thought, it's like, okay, this all operates within the law, and especially stickering as well. It's everywhere. It's in every urban centre. It's on every surface. So I thought, this seems to be a legitimate way to express your political beliefs. You know, I mean, I live in Leeds, and the town centre is just plastered with like socialist worker posters all over the place. You know, so it's like, all right, well, no one's arresting them. You know, everyone knows where the Socialist Worker Party resides, and no one's nicking them. So I thought, all right, I guess I can do this as well. And that carried on for about 6 years, right up until kind of like late 2020. But when I first met Mark, that was 2019. I attended his kind of Camp Collet thing. And at the time, maybe 30 of us were there. And a few months later, he launched Patriotic Alternative. And I attended that first conference. And the people who I saw there, the people who I spoke to, I was like, okay, this seems to be a kind of real life movement that I could get involved with. And I did, you know, as soon as Mark started asking for regional organizers, I put myself forward for Yorkshire, and I got involved with that. And as I got involved with that, the 100 handers kind of faded into the background. And by late 2020, I'd kind of mothballed it, because I mean, at this point as well, after 6 years, I've put out 300 plus stickers. You know, every time it came time for another monthly release, I felt like I was kind of reinventing the wheel. And just rewording previous stickers that I've already done. So I'd kind of put it to rest, and I was focusing on my work with Patriotic Alternative. And then a Hope Not Hate piece came out, kind of exposing me as the head of the 100 handers. And as you can probably tell, speaking to me, I've got quite a distinctive stutter, and I think I'd done two or three
I haven't noticed.
Oh, right, okay. Maybe it's got better. But they'd drawn the line and says, you know, this is clearly who it is and everything. And weeks went past, months went past, and nothing came of it. And I thought, well, if I'm going to get arrested, surely it would have been right after I've been identified. But nothing came. And then it ended up being 6 months later. I was dropping off some parcels at the post office from my wife's tea and coffee business. And I turned around, and this police officer just like slapped the cuffs on me, took me outside and said I was being done for distribution of material meant to incite racial hatred. And I was like, oh, okay. And turns out that counterterrorism had been trying to find out who I was for 2 years leading up to this point. Quite why, I don't know, because it is just stickers.
Spending all their money on stickers, counterterrorism unit for 2 years, and you have all these illegal brownoids running around there doing God knows what in the UK.
Yeah.
God knows what, being something super criminal.
When I was first arrested, there were two charges that would have breached terrorism laws, which was possession of terrorist material. And then stickers. The other one was...
What was the diciest... Like, what was the... I know the stickers are like, what, Keep Britain White and stuff like that. I'm trying to think of the one I remember seeing. Was it... There was stuff... not... replacement stickers, or was it white genocide stickers? What was the...
I mean, they literally covered every topic you could think of.
I gotcha.
At one point during the trial, me and Laura actually went through them and totaled up how many made reference to race or diversity, multiculturalism, immigration, because obviously the whole trial was about the whole idea of the 100 Handers Project was to incite racial hatred. So we're like, okay. It's like, okay, how many of them actually talk about race? You know, if this is the sole intent of the project. And it turned out to be like 13%. So it wasn't even that many. When I was arrested, there were two other charges, and one possession of terrorist material. And then the other one was something to do with like international funding for terrorism. Like I'd been receiving money from Russia in order to do these stickers and everything. And it's like, no, I'm literally just doing it off my own back, and you know, the stickers cost pennies, and you know, it's nothing that really requires international funding. But those were dropped immediately as soon as I got into questioning. You know, they'd searched the house, not found piles of money, not found any terrorist material, and counterterrorism was stuck kind of like, you know, you know, cock in hand. I'm just like, you've got a guy for stickers. So I think they were a bit let down. I think they were really thinking this was going to lead to a major conviction of someone who was networked. And it's like, no, it was literally me just doing it all by myself.
Yeah, they were hoping for caches of weapons and underground layer full of bomb-making materials. And these guys are so crazy, they believe their own propaganda. Or maybe it's not their own propaganda. It's the various different anti-white groups.
Yeah, I mean, when you find out during my trial, there was an expert witness called by the prosecution, and he's a professor at a university here in England, but he runs the Searchlight Archive, and the Searchlight is like a old school kind of like Antifa publication, but he runs the archive there, so he maintains that. And he does these courses on, like, you know, 100 years of resisting fascism and all this. But in his work, he advises counterterrorism, he advises the police on how to deal with the far right. And it's like, well, if you're going to have ideologues like that, providing the basis of, you know, who needs to be gone after, who needs to be arrested, who needs to be pursued, then it's like you are going to end up going down these avenues where you're picking people up for sharing music, or in this case, stickers that they had to admit. You know, when I couldn't believe it when we got the case summary against us, and it says, like, you know, as far as, you know, for the most part, mainstream political opinions, ranging to extreme but lawful, stickers on based on immigration. And it was kind of like, right, so we're not even saying the stickers themselves breach the law. Our entire trial was based around information from my, like, personal messages that they'd found after the arrest. So there was basically no basis for the arrest in the first place, because the material was legal, the material was true. And then we spent an entire trial just basically doing like a character assassination upon me, taking jokes out of context, you know, just humor between friends, and spinning it up as really nefarious.
They also took a bunch of your wife's things as well, right?
Oh, they cleaned the house out.
That's what I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, literally.
And when exactly was this? What was the date where they showed up at your house unexpected, and you guys were, or she was sleeping, or was it early?
Yeah,
was it late?
April 2024, and it was first thing in the morning. I was on my way to work, and after they arrested me, they took my house keys, and they let themselves into our house.
They can actually do that. They can take house keys.
Apparently, yeah. You know, they had a warrant.
Okay.
I would have thought that would require before you let yourself in.
Right. I guess that's kind of better than them breaking down the door with your wife and kids there and stuff like that.
Yeah, it was a very nice door.
Maybe, I don't know. I'd have to debate that.
Yeah, but I mean, when you've got, from Laura's perspective, she's, you know, having a lie-in. I've gone to work, and then all of a sudden, three men in plain clothes, like, they weren't identified as police officers. They hadn't announced themselves as when they were coming up the stairs either. They just basically walked into the bedroom. She thought she was about to get jumped by Antifa or something.
Reasonable.
Yeah, but instead, I think it was a dozen or so officers basically just turned our house upside down, took every electronic device going. Didn't matter whether it belonged to Laura or me, and left us just completely, you know, shell shocked really from it all. I think we had a few people from the PA community kind of stop by. We hadn't been heard from for 3 days. It's like we just had no way of contacting anyone. I think Laura had a backup phone at her grandma's that she was able to call Mark on and inform him what had happened. But really, yeah, it just come completely out of the blue, and they'd come in really heavy handed for stickers, you know. And I mean, I was dead to rights as the head of the 100-handers. You know, my desk was covered in like half finished stickers and everything.
Paraphernalia.
So, yeah. So we never tried to.
They caught you with
deny.
The goods.
Yeah. It's kind of like, there's a printer here. There's like, must be over 100 stickers that he's like test printed and everything here. It's like, oh my
They're
God.
Like taking pictures of it like it's some kind of murder scene or something.
Oh, yeah. That was all in the evidence bundle. It was pretty wild. See how seriously they took it, really. But yeah, and then being questioned for 4 hours, in regard to this stuff, and I really just couldn't believe it. It's like these stickers that I've worked so hard to ensure stayed within the law, and here I am being questioned over them, but not over like, well, yeah, it's like not there wasn't a single sticker that I felt like. Yeah, that's the one that got me. As it was, I mean, we were even able to provide evidence. You know, when you download the 100 Handers pack, you can check the change log even now because they took away my devices. I couldn't delete the 100 Handers Telegram channel or anything, so that's all still there. The stickers are still available to download and everything. So they've kind of shot themselves in the foot in that regard.
Gave you a lot of publicity, that's for sure.
Yeah, but it's like the change log is there, and I think sometime in like 2018 or something, I delete a sticker because I felt it bordered too closely on inciting racial hatred. And it's like that, sure, that alone I would have thought would have been a kill shot to the prosecution's argument. It's like, well, you're saying that's my intent. Here's me deleting something that would have fulfilled that intent. So surely that would be enough. But it wasn't like that. It's like the prosecution just buried me under a ton of crap, and when you're up there in the dock trying to explain an in-joke between friends to a jury who are completely uninitiated in the kind of meme culture and everything, it's like, oh my god.
No.
I felt cringe doing it.
Right. We're going to go to your time in jail here in a minute, but I'm curious about mm-hmm. this because Gamergate comes up a lot of times over here, but typically you're dealing with right-wing characters who are not necessarily ethno-nationalists, not necessarily what I would call pro-white. They're on the fringes. Mm-hmm. They'll talk about topics. They certainly are friendly. They don't disagree with things, but they're not going to join something like a patriotic alternative. They're not going to go into actual activism, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. How many of your peer group friends in and around Patriotic Alternative and otherwise were influenced by Gamergate? Are you the only one, or is this like all my friends were influenced by Gamergate? And what exactly in Gamergate in the UK influenced you? What exactly, what catalyst? Was it a particular game? Because I am not like a Gamergate historian, but I'm just curious because you're the first person I've talked to out of the UK like this.
Yeah, the Gamergate thing, from what I remember, it was basically the exposure of organized media networks, and that obviously has implications for other media aside from gaming media. But it's basically like there was sexual favors paid for positive reviews on games and relationships between different reviewers and all this. But basically, it meant that the whole game review market was contrived, so you could have like just absolute trash reviewed highly because, well, they've been sleeping with the developers, or they're in some poly couple with a few of the others, or anything like that. But I think it's probably just realizing, basically, that politically, I'm going to have to get engaged at some point because it's leaked into my hobby here. And then once you start looking elsewhere online, and you're aware that these networks exist, then you start finding, coincidences with names, and you start reading stuff. I think I went from there into reading some of the kind of early Manosphere stuff, like Chateau Artiste and everything.
Oh, yeah. He was big at the time. Huge.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't even know if he's still around or anything.
No, I think I found like an archive of his like a few years back. But whoever he was, also kind of started to dabble in the kind of right-wing political sphere.
Oh, 100%.
And I think at one point, I remember him seeing, like, he shared a 100 Handers sticker to his blog. Yeah. And I was like, oh, right, that's cool.
Yeah, he was at the beginning of the acceleration of meme wars. He would dabble in various different memes I was dabbling in at the time. So there's no doubt about that. He was very much in the know of what was current online.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So that's how you got into that, all right?
Yeah, I never restricted myself to a certain network. So, you can have like your Sargons of the CADs, you'd have people who become fans of him, but then stay very much within his milieu, and it'd be people who wouldn't want to go too far. So they kind of
he's made some transformations. Supposedly.
100%. I mean, he's come kicking and screaming. It's been a long time coming. You know, I mean, to say that we essentially started at the same point, and I'm where I am, and he's kind of been coming up slowly but surely from behind. It's good to see. But then at the same time, you know, you look at the guest list who he has on his show, and it's like, okay, there's still a lot of curation going on behind the scenes as to who you want to talk to, who you want to provide exposure to. In terms of the actual, like, from who to who, I couldn't put a finger on it. I mean, I remember being on like 4chan back in the day, you know, and you'd be on poll and laughing at, you know, racial memes and stuff. I think it was just being open to new voices and then reading more. You know, you'd look at the Daily Stormer, you know, wasn't quite to my taste, a bit hardcore for my liking, or a bit, not vitriolic, but what's the word? Also, being here in the UK, it's like, you know, plastering everything in swastikas and racial slurs. You just think, like, this is going to get me nicked.
You're just going to ask for trouble, yeah.
That
would be my thinking. Because even here, yeah, you can go up and down the street with even, like, a rebel flag, but doing that in the wrong area, you're just going to invite conflict, and that conflict, you're going to be the one that goes to jail for a long time, no matter who's in the wrong. So you're constantly looking at it like, because of your politics, especially if you're out in the open, which you are right now, you have been for quite a long time, you really want to go out of your way to be careful. So that's okay. You know, which is, did it come up in the trial that you had moved your stickers around or that you had deleted stickers? Did your barrister or what, that's what you call attorneys, that right? Barrister?
Did yes. Right? Yeah, yeah.
Did your barrister bring it up in front of the judge, or was he not allowed to?
No, yeah, we brought this stuff up, but the way British trial works is basically the prosecution goes first and just gets to absolutely bury you, and then it's your defense turn, and that's when you have to try and dig yourself out from the mountain of crap he's buried you under. So we had an American lawyer friend over, and he couldn't believe it because he's used to, you know, people going like objection when something's raised that it's completely beyond the pale.
Was that allowed at one time? And because British common law, American law, based on British common law, you know, Anglo-Saxon common law. So I mean, we're kind of intertwined, with the exception of a couple states, maybe. Was this type of thing allowed at one time? Was it not allowed in your type of case? Why are they not allowed to object?
I mean, I think it's just, I mean, you know, you Americans, you're a bit more brash. You just I presume when you went over there, you decided, like, no, we need to make it so we can interrupt each other, because it's been really annoying having to listen to these trials, which is just one and then the other. But as far as I'm aware, this is how.
Well, I mean, they can enter hearsay evidence. They can enter in various different evidence that aren't actually evidence. The whole entire point of an objection is, like, it's hearsay, and the objection can be sustained or it can be overruled. You hear this all the time in U.S. court, you know, you can't let a prosecutor just bury someone with evidence that's flimsy or manufactured, especially you're dealing with a jury trial. You know, judges are sophisticated, juries are not necessarily, and you're not necessarily in front of a jury of your peers these days at all.
Yeah, I mean, this was I definitely wasn't, three weren't even my own countrymen, it was definitely an education, this trial. I mean, we only found out about halfway through that we were, as the defense, that we were entitled to enter a bundle of evidence. So one night, me and Laura were just frantically putting together something so that we'd have to present when it came to our turn to defend. Because the way the prosecution was framing it was that by me talking about the grooming gangs, they didn't actually exist. I was fantasizing in order to just excuse my own racist beliefs. So we felt like, well, I didn't think I'd have to provide evidence to the grooming gangs. I didn't think but, you know, 2 years ago, this is where Britain was at, you know.
Because now it's like a statement of national fact. It is.
Yeah, and it's like, and that was really surprising coming out 2 years later. and finding the states being like, yeah, we always knew they're existing, and yeah, we know who's doing it. And it's like, oh, right, okay. So it's like, I think my trial would have gone very differently today than it did then. We got the evidence pack beforehand, but it felt like the stuff that they were bringing up through the trial, I was like, I didn't see any of this in there. You know, they had like news stories about razor blades behind stickers and everything.
What?
Inferring that was, you know, related to me. And
razor
I was like,
blades behind stickers.
I know, it's like a common leftist fantasy that right wingers put razor blade behind stickers. I mean, you'd have to be some kind of retarded not to notice a razor blade behind a, you know, paper
sounds
thin
kind of
sticker.
Dangerous putting up a sticker with a bare hand and a razor blade. Wow.
Yeah. There was stuff like that, and they had a whole list of basically like every sticker that they could find and record within the UK and the location of it and what it said on it and everything. And again, I hadn't seen this in the evidence pack before the trial, but we were going through it line by line. It took forever. It was about two days worth of just running through that stuff. And
there's no discovery then at all.
No, and somewhere down south, it's like they'd just inserted two stickers that had some really inflammatory statements. And I had to put my hand up because I was just in the fishbowl at the back of the court. You know, you're not sat, you know, next to your lawyer or anything as you are in America. You're just in a glass bowl, expected to just observe proceedings, essentially.
Were you held? Did they let you out on bond? Did you not have bond? How did the arrest go? Because you're saying you were questioned. Were you held without bond? How did all this go?
Yeah, so here in the UK, we've got something called released under investigation, which is basically like indefinite. There are some restrictions, but normally not too bad. I mean, I think the only restriction I had was I wasn't allowed to stay anywhere else other than home overnight. But other than that, I was free to do with whatever I wanted. And that continued for 2 years until they finally brought charges. And then it was another year again until the trial date. But I wasn't held on remand. I wasn't imprisoned for any of that time. And then between the guilty verdict and sentencing, there was a month as well. And they didn't hold me in remand for then as well. But I mean, frankly, just because there was no threat to the public from me. I wasn't that type of criminal. But pending that or post that arrest, I think my political activity must have gone up 3-4-fold. You know, that then from there we were doing, you know, megaphone demonstrations outside the migrant hotels, banner drops, all this kind of stuff that we hadn't done before. So but then none of that appeared in the trial. You know, they couldn't use any of that against me. So it was all based on these stickers and my secret intent behind them.
Intriguing. So how long did you actually, what was, you had to turn yourself into jail, or did you turn yourself in at the local courts to go to jail? How does jail work in the UK? The UK is not as bad as America, but I'm guessing they have some pretty bad jails. Usually they do.
Yeah, I mean, the ones down south.
Rising number of nons, which means rising level of dangerous jails. There can also be dangerous whites as well, a handful of murderers, rapists, whatevers. Tell us about jail, how you turned yourself in, and how what happened from there.
Yeah, well, with sentencing here, if it's custodial sentence, you're taken straight down from the dock. So I had a bag packed with me. I had a pre-sentence report that basically said that they don't recommend a custodial sentence. They recommend suspending it and community service, essentially. But as soon as we got in there, the judge came out and he had a face full of thunder. And I was like, oh, he's definitely sending me down. And we got 2 years. And from there, you're taken downstairs into a cell and transported to the nearest prison. And that was pretty terrifying. I think it's every kind of guy's worst nightmare is just going to prison because, I mean, we get a lot of American media about prison, and it just seems to be rapes and murders like
it's
every
bad,
day. Yeah. And it's like, thankfully, British prisons aren't quite like that yet. So we were, got in there. It was late at night, and the prison just seems to go on forever. You know, three floors of cell doors and everything. And But it didn't actually turn out to be as bad as I was expecting. You know, I spent 10 months in there in total because of prison overcrowding. Instead of doing 50% of your term, you now do 40%. So I only did 10 months instead of the full year.
Wow, 50% of a term, that's not bad at all. So a two-year term, I thought it would be like 80% or something.
I think if you're doing over 5 years, you do two-thirds or something like
okay.
that.
But for it short, just depends on how harsh the crime is. So we're only going to keep the guy in jail for a year for stickers.
Yeah, I mean, talking to every other prisoner, and it's like they couldn't believe what I was in for. You know, you got people in there for grievous bodily harm, murder, dealing drugs, and everything. Then you'd be
in
like,
your
yeah,
particular,
I'm in
were you in a? I mean, here we have maximum, medium, and low security prison. What can you describe? Is this low security? Was Laura able to visit you? Were you in isolation? Did the guards treat you a certain way? Give me an overview of what prison's like first day in the UK. I mean, here it's like dungeons, but I don't know what to expect. Was it low security?
Yeah.
Were you allowed outside? Give me an overview.
Was it HMP Leeds where I landed? That is I believe it's a high security. For my own categorization, I was categorized as Cat B, which is reserved for murderers, high-profile drug dealers, people who are high escape risks or high violence risks.
Your average pro-white sticker bandit gets treated like an axe murderer. That's scary, but
yeah,
doesn't surprise me.
The thing with Cat B prisons is they don't take you unless you're doing over 2 years because it's such a rigmarole to get you in there and everything. Mm. So I was kept in remand prisons, which is... most of the people in there are awaiting trial or awaiting sentencing. So I think that leads to slightly better behavior because people aren't wanting to add charges before they've even been found guilty. You know, they're on the best behavior, essentially. But yeah, first getting in there, it's like you're observing and, you know, everyone's out on social. And here in the UK, we've got a lot of Victorian prisons. So like HMP Leeds was built in like 1870.
Wow.
So it is in a bad state by this point. You know, the cell doesn't have windows and it's a bit colder here. And
do you have a roommate? Do you have a cellmate? Not a roommate, cellmate.
Initially, I did, but quickly they moved me into solo cells because the risk of me radicalizing people.
Well, that at least helps you out because I would rather be alone.
Oh God, yeah.
Than with a cellmate that you have no clue.
Yeah, I think I held my first dump in for about 4 days until I was finally alone. This is kind of like that was a big bridge to cross, you know.
What color jumpsuit do they put you guys in over there? Do they put you in sweatpants or something? What do they put you guys in?
Sweatpants, yeah. It's all gray, all just light gray with prison name emblazoned upon them. So, yeah, no orange jumpsuits or anything. Yeah, and very quickly, that's only... If you haven't got anything else, you can wear that, but you can have clothes shipped in. And I think there's only a few limits. Like you can't have hoods. They can't be all black.
You can wear your own clothes in prison. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like you'd have people, you'd have people kind of flexing on others because they've got, you know, the Nike track suits and
I would imagine in some of those max security prisons, they don't allow that though, because that would be kind of risky allowing people to ship things in.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the remand prison thing. It's the fact that people in there aren't necessarily guilty yet. Like a lot of the people I was in with basically got walkouts, either the insufficient evidence for it to go to trial and everything. But by this point, they've already spent 3-4 months inside.
What
so
do you mean
like,
walkout? What does walkout mean? They get to walk
so
out?
Like they would get to trial, especially in a lot of domestic abuse cases, because it'd basically just be he said, she said. Mm. It would get there and the prosecution would be like, we don't have sufficient evidence to mount a case.
But they kept him in jail up until that time?
Yeah, yeah. Jeez. So it's like you'd have guys who have been in there 3-4 months, they've lost the job and, you know, it's like ruined their life.
Holy
and then it's just
shit.
Like, you know, don't worry about it. And on the way, and it's like, oh my God, this woman has just ruined your life. it's pretty wild. But yeah, it's a relatively relaxed atmosphere. It feels almost like an adult daycare, except there's this undercurrent of violence. like every so often you'll have someone jump on the suicide netting or I think I saw within
What is suicide netting? What does that mean?
So you've got three floors, and basically and it's like an open wing. So all the cells are up the side, and it goes up three floors, and there's landing. So if you were to jump off the third floor, you've got a hell of a fall onto, you know, a very hard surface. And at some point, they introduce this kind of wire meshing on the top of the first floor. So if you're on the ground floor, it's right above your head. You can basically reach out and touch it, but it's there to stop people throwing themselves off the third floor and killing themselves.
Makes sense.
I mean, a third floor fall onto like hard wire grating and probably
it's basically, you know, a suicide prevention.
Yeah, yeah. But I think I saw two people get kettled within the first 2 weeks, which is basically you boil up a kettle full of water and then throw it on someone. And then if you're feeling really vindictive, you'll put sugar in it so that that also melts into the skin and, you know, makes the scarring a lot worse. So it's like everyone seems to be having a good time. However, you're aware that there's kind of prison politics and vendettas put out against certain people, and drugs are rife as well. So people.
What were the ethnic stats of this particular jail?
Leeds was very mixed. And I think while I was there, I saw it become more Asian on my wing, to the point where they started on an evening, they'd sing the call to prayer through like the crack of the cell door.
When you say Asian, kind of, he's talking about, for the American audience, he's talking Pakistani by and large.
Yeah, predominantly Pakistani. Yeah, not many Sikhs or anything. It was predominantly Pakistani. And then you've got like an Albanian contingent. I think it's the Albanian incarceration rate in the UK is something mad. Like it's like 8 out of 10 will go to prison at some point. Like the only Albanians here are involved in organized crime, basically.
They're gangsters, basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm, the ones that go to jail, generally speaking, here are by and large, the statistics are they're usually in some kind of mob. It's more like a mob than a conventional gang, although they might have those as well. But here it's like an Albanian mob.
Yeah, it's clearly very organized with a very hierarchy. And everything. Yeah.
It's like business.
I mean, you'd speak to white drug dealers and they would be bemoaning the fact that the Albanians have come in and basically completely destroyed their business because they're just so organized and so professional with it. You know, there's that. But then you'll have... at Leeds, they have a dedicated wing for sex offenders, because if sex offenders are allowed into general population, they'll basically just get attacked, you know, potentially murdered. So they have their own wing.
Is that like an automatic rule? That over here, it's like a green light. Like if you have a sex offender, it's just like you're done. You're cooked.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much prison policy.
Yeah, I think when a sex offender goes in, they're allowed to sign a piece of paper. That's basically, it's like you can either go on the wing with all the other sex offenders or you can go into general population. However, whatever happens to you at that point isn't our fault, because we've offered you safety and you've opted to, you know, not go with it. So you'd find people who would get exposed as sex offenders, rapists, pedophiles, and they would very quickly be attacked. And it's funny because you have like the officers when you first come in, they're like, oh, you know, don't talk about your offences with other prisoners. But it's literally the first question everyone asks you, because everyone's very aware that they are about and they are hiding. So the first question you get is, what are you in for? And if you're umming and ahhing or you refuse to say, the assumption is you're a nonce and you'll get hit right then and there. So it's like everyone's talking about what they're offending. And there was a point on D-Way, I think within a week, I think two of them had been exposed, and it's like the suspicion was on everyone. And I was joking around saying, it's like, we're going to have to post our charges to our doors, because at the moment, everyone's getting the side eye. And especially for me, when people were like, oh, like you're in for stickers. They were kind of like, what? And they're like, nah,
it's kind of hard to believe.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were like, oh, clearly he must be covering for something. But, you know, people had like contraband phones. So I was like, no, Google my name. You'll see me. I'm right there. You know? But then that then increased my profile, because, you know, everyone in there hates sex offenders, and it's like, it's me going down for a sticker campaign, you know, against grooming gangs, you know, which everyone in there is kind of like, fucking hate them. But what I was saying about F-Wing, the sex offender wing, it was almost 100% Pakistani male.
Oh, wow.
You know, so it's like, and that kind of does something to red pill the officers there. You know, it's kind of hard to ignore the grooming gang issue when you're looking at an entire sex offender wing staffed by them. And then eventually I moved over to Hull in East Yorkshire, which is a lot more demographically homogenous white. And the prison itself, again, you know, didn't see many, if any, Asians of any nationality.
Was it safer?
I think that's why they moved me. I think the amount of mail I was receiving in Leeds and the protests that had happened in Leeds City Centre related to my conviction led them to understand that it's like if something was to happen to me, it would be really bad PR for them. So I think that's why they moved me over to Hull. And yeah, Hull was a lot more pleasant, I suppose you'd say, a lot whiter. And I think without the racial diversity, there did seem to be a lot less tension. You know, people were a lot more relaxed for the most part. Still old Victorian wings and everything, but at that point, the most dangerous kind of people were the mentally ill. You know, we've had asylums shut down here for decades now, and it shows in the prison population. There's a lot of people who'd be better served by some sort of mental health institute and being sectioned there. I mean, God, there was one guy who'd literally, he'd like Joker smiled himself and not allowed it to heal. So he just had this big, like, Itchy the Killer smile and just covered in scars head to toe. And I think I eventually, he got moved off the wing.
Did they have like a protective custody at that prison as well? They must have.
Yeah. That was, I and J were the sex offender wings over in Hull. Predominantly white there, just because that's the demographics of the area. Sure. So, you know, that's who they'd picked up. I mean, Leeds Prison, you're right next door to Bradford. Both Bradford and Leeds have quite a sizable Pakistani population. And, you know, Keithley, one of the famous towns for the raid gangs, would have fed into that prison as well. I mean, it was...
Uh-oh. What happened? There we go. You all right?
Sorry, I just,
that's yeah, all right.
Was it outside? Was it during the sentencing? I think it was during the trial. During the trial, where I was having to argue that rape gangs even existed, there was a case across the hall of a rape gang where they were being tried, and it just felt like beyond parody. That it's like I'm here having to defend myself to, you know, remain free, when it's like the evidence of what I was talking about is literally here in the core building. But yeah, it's where were we?
Well, so basically, what is the, because I've heard the food in the UK prisons is like a lot better than the food here, or maybe it's not. I don't remember. Varies. I think Mark was telling me that the food there wasn't anything as bad as here, but I don't know what he knows about it. I could be wrong. Maybe it wasn't Mark, but
definitely nothing to write home about.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Wasn't bad. I mean, the problem
was
with
it
Leeds
actually.
Was...
But here they don't even serve food. <It's> not, you know, I don't know. So
yeah, I mean, the problem with Leeds was that the kitchen jobs where you're making preparing the food was the they were exclusively for the sex offenders, so everyone was very aware that it's like everything that's going into your mouth has been prepared by just the absolute dregs of humanity.
Wow, they let sex offenders make the food. That would be a riot over here.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, people definitely weren't happy about it, but then it was also kind of like, well, what's the other option? I think they were talking about changing it at some point. Hull was better. The food was better, but then also it was just regular prisoners preparing the food. My kind of work background is in sign making, so like graphic design and stuff. And there was a potential job going in Hull for that. And I was like, all right, I'll sign up for that. And I showed up to the workshop, And the guy running it was kind of just pulled me aside, and he's like, "Oh, you should probably know that everyone else here is a sex offender. We've only just opened this up to regular prisoners, but no one's taken it up yet." And it's like, "How would you feel working alongside them day to day?" And I was like, "No,
there's yeah, you no don't fucking want to be branded way." That.
No, God no. And it's like, you know, it's like, what am I going to do? Hang out and be friendly with like someone who's molested kids? It's like, get the fuck out of it. So didn't pursue that job in the end, but yeah, the food was, you know, it is what it is, but I mean, they just throw carbs at you. It was pretty wild, just the amount of chips and crisps and chocolates they'll throw at you. Protein is the hard thing to come by. You know, you'll get the world's tiniest pork chop and then like a full plate of chips along with it. But I managed to, through a kind of like incel exercise regime, and then whenever we got exercise, I'd just be running for the entire time, and then just watching what I ate.
Did you have a canteen where you could buy, because here a lot of guys, you know, they get their protein, they got to supplement their protein because of slop in jail, from the canteen or whatever they call it, commissary. It's like a little store basically, and they basically
yeah, it's basically it's like a kind of inventory of like your local corner shop, and you can buy your
ridiculous prices generally. But were you able to get tuna or canned chicken or any type of decent food there?
Yeah, that was the kind of staple. Every week it'd be a few things, and you knew what you were going to have. Like on Wednesday one week, you'd be ordering your food for Wednesday the next week, and then if you knew what you were going to be having, you could then organize what you wanted to order to basically supplement the meal to fill it out, you know. So if you knew you were going to have I don't know, like a baked potato with cottage cheese, you know, it's like, all right, I can order some beans to go with that. But yeah, it's like you try and supplement where you could, but then through the canteen you could also buy matchsticks and glue, and you know, toiletries and everything. I mean, some places you can get fresh fruit. It wasn't available at our prison, but I've heard it is about there. But yeah, and then protein powder, Jesus, that was that really cost if you wanted to go for that. And
could you? Because here, depending on the prison, I guess, by and large, you could get like packages from home. Could Laura send you like protein powder or whatever it is your favorite things are at home? Could she send you things or bring it to you?
No, the most you can get is books, but then even the books they have to, you know, they peruse them. I think I had a box full of them that had been denied me when I got back, when they let me out. But yeah, you can't send anything beyond clothes and books. You can place an order through like Argos, but then, you know, I think I placed an order for like I'd saved up my canteen for a few weeks, and I ordered a keyboard and some headphones. Because I was like, I'll try and learn piano while I'm in here. And they came back and said, you can't have the keyboard. However, we have ordered you the headphones. And I was like, what the hell am I supposed to plug it into? Like, I've got a pair of headphones with nothing to plug into. It's like, just deny me the whole order if you're going to do that. But yeah, I think once you got into the proper prisons, your Cat B's, your Cat C's, whatever, you know, the non-remand prisons, that's when you'd be able to order a lot more. And you see on TV the kind of documentaries, the kind of setups the prisoners have there, it's a lot more settled because you're going to be there for 10, 15 years, you know, whereas for me it was like, all right, 10 months, you know, they don't let you get too settled in here.
Interesting. All right. Were you under any type of restrictions at all in jail?
Yeah, I was classified as a tact offender, which is not only reserved for tact. Basically, means you've committed a it stands for Terrorism Act.
Oh God!
So offences under the Terrorism Act. I hadn't been found guilty of those. I was found guilty under the public order offences. However, the stickers were described as terrorism adjacent. So I was designated a tact offender, which meant that I couldn't get any kind of job that meant that I had to leave the wing. You know, I had to have a solo cell. But otherwise, I was treated as well, if not I mean, you know, I got quite friendly with the officers. They appreciate you not being a raving schizophrenic or on drugs all the time. So I got in pretty well with them. So I got pretty favorable treatment from those. And I ended up getting basically the highest level job that's available on the wing, which is the servery, the people who actually dish out the food. You know, obviously you get whatever excess of food there is, but also the soft power that comes with that, which is basically, you know, if someone makes an enemy of you, they're not getting fed, and the officers are going to look the other way. So it came with a lot of prestige, and I found that the friends I was making were also the kind of people who had their shit together and kind of rose up to kind of dominate the wings, as they were. I mean, you know, by the end of it, H-Wing, I mean, my friend group basically ran that wing. How, you know, definitely won't by any virtue of me being there. I was kind of riding the coattails, but yeah, it's
so basically there was no dining hall. You ate in your cells.
Yeah. Everyone comes down, walks through the servery, you know, gets fed the slop, and then they return to their cells to eat. You know, and you have your one tray and your set of cutlery, and you're expected to clean it and reuse it throughout. I mean, I had a plate that stayed with me for the 10 months that I was there. I mean, you'd have some people who just every day they'd come down and they'd be like, it's like, I need a new plate. And you'd be like, what are you doing the old one? And then they'd move out and you'd look at the cell and they just had a stack of dirty plates under the table. And I mean, God, the squalor that some people found acceptable to live in while you're there. You know, they'd cover the windows with sheets, block the air vents, and never turn the light on. And it's like just the stench that some people.
Oh, you think the guards would go in there and drag them out and give them the brutal?
Yeah, I think
that's what they.
I think
do
there
here.
Was only one time we did a forced clean, and it was clearly autistic or something. I mean, he really shouldn't have been in prison. He was
mentally ill.
And just terrified. Like he absolutely fucking terrified, and people obviously took the piss out of him. You know, toyed with him a bit. And I think when he went to court, we were forced to do a clean of his room. And I mean, God knows what he'd been doing, but those bed sheets looked like a murder scene. And then he just had a stack of paper. And do you remember in Fight Club when they find that guy's like ramblings? And it's that kind of like psychotic writing where there's no space between the words and everything. It's just a fully blocked edge to edge on the page and everything. And he just had a stack of writing like that. I just like read the top sheet and I was like, this guy is absolutely nuts. But yeah, he just had like bits of half eaten food all over the place and everything. You're like, oh my God. And then you'd have the people, you know, blocking the toilets and everything. You're like, just disgusting. but then conversely, you'd have some people who like their cell. And I was like, this is like, it was my pride and joy. You know, it's needs to be spotlessly clean, fresh, airy, bright, you know. I wasn't about to let that place go to the dogs.
Let me cruise down through here and let me get some super chats because we've got some in here. Aaron White, thank you very much. Let me get through a handful of these. Mr. Smalls, I find it ironic that broadcasters will fawn over Sam and what he did and suffer for stickers for the sake of an hour full of content. Well, won't marshal their audience to use chalk URLs for our cause. Now, I thought he was talking about something like fancy, like some kind of fancy URL that I didn't know about. He's actually talking about chalk. He's being goofy. But anyways. But thanks, you guys. Stick sent me here. Sam, glad you are back with your wonderful family. You're a strong one. Tim, dumb question, but what service is your paywall through? Well, it's whiterabbitradio.net by and large. And to get it, what you get is the back catalog and MP3s or downloadable videos of these once they're done. But these days I probably only put a couple shows a month at max, maybe one or two shows a month max beyond the paywall, if that. So most of it's free. But to sign up for that, you would have to, how do I access it? Go to whiterabbitradio.net, get yourself a username and a password. Obviously, free to sign up. And then you would have to send something through as a super chat. And preferably Power Chat, but you could use Entropy as well. I always prefer Power Chat these days. They take less. And if you want a 3 month, 6 month, whatever. But you can also email any questions, email below, and I'll fill you in. But there's a lot of historic content on there going back. But these days, most everything is free. There are, like every other Wednesday, I put stuff up on the paywall. I'm trying to, at least. But there was a time when it was nothing but paywall, because that's what, well, not nothing but. There were a lot of free stuff, but that's pretty much sustained everything, let's say back in like 2013 or something like that. You get an idea. There's lots of interviews there, historic interviews, so on and so forth, etc. Any questions, just email the email address in the description, and I'll try to fill you in as best I can. But you got to send in a super chat, basically, with your username. There is not a processor, per se. Crafty Booms, but I do appreciate this, the super chat and the kind words of Sam. Crafty Booms, no Grandma Towers tea. That's rubbish, mate. Might as well be tortured. Oh, they didn't allow you any tea in prison?
No. And actually, I actually got banned for working for Grandma Towlers after I was released, because they hadn't really looked at Grandma Towlers, the tea company. And then eventually they looked at the website, and on the About Us page, it says that we use the profits for projects that benefit our people. And it says, it's like, well, our people are so overtly racist. and I was like, what? How's that racist? And they're like, well, it just is. You can't work for Grandma Towlers because it's not helping your rehabilitation. I was like, all right, okay. I end up carrying on doing it, but just not telling them, you know. And it's like, you people, man, you just, any little thing that you can try and twist a knife on me with, they did it.
So when you were released, did you have some kind of half release? You're probably under some type of probation, but they don't call it probation there. What do they call it?
No, it's called license. So you're out on license. And I was being dealt with by the National Security Division.
Oh, God.
Which tells you how seriously they took the stickers. But normally, when you're out on license, you stay at a halfway house for 1, maybe 2 months, and then you move on. You know, whether it's into council housing or whatever. But because I was with National Security Division, they were able to keep me there for up to 12 months. So I was looking at basically my entire time out on license. I thought they'd have me in this AP. And they ended up keeping me there for 7 months, 8 months, I think it was. I think it was July I got out. I got released in December, and July I finally got able to return home properly. I had a curfew of 7 p.m. until 6 a.m., which meant for a few months I couldn't help put the kids to bed.
So at the prison, was Laura allowed to visit? Were people allowed to visit you at all? Were you allowed phone calls?
Yeah, because I was convicted, I was allowed 2 visits a month. If you're awaiting trial, I think you're allowed up to 4 visits a week. But I was convicted, I was allowed 2 visits a month. And then as soon as I got in there, I wanted to get enhanced status, which is basically you're afforded a little bit more on your canteen, and you also get double the visits. And I knew that my second daughter would be born about a month into my time inside. So I wanted to make sure I had the extra visits in time for that. And I did, you know, I did absolutely everything I could in order to get these IEP points, which, like, what does it stand for again? Something like something about earning privileges points. And you get them for various things. I mean, one night, I think there was some guy who said he was shouting from his cell saying he was going to kill himself unless he got a charger for his vape pen. They've banned tobacco in British prisons, so now everyone has these little vape pens, and vape cartridges become the currency. But he was saying he was going to hang himself unless he got a vape charger. So, and the guards were panicking, and I just said through a door, it's like, I've got a vape charger, I don't even use it. I just got some vapes in order to be able to trade them, but he can have the charger. And they're like, oh, brilliant, thank you. They ran off, and they got the number one. There's basically only one guy in the prison who's got a key for the cells overnight, basically to stop any kind of hanky-panky going on. And he came, unlocked me and everything, and gave the charger to him, and he quieted down. But they were like, okay, yeah, we'll give you a point. I did a few other things like that around the wing in order to get the extra visits. But yeah, those were such a lifeline, especially once Violet was born, my daughter. to, I think I saw her 3 days. I think we had her booked on a visit before she was even born, because we knew it took so long to process the whole thing. So we just made up a date of birth for her and put her on the visit list. But yeah, seeing them, it was amazing, but also really rough at the same time, like having to say goodbye to them, having not seen them for a week. It's really, really tough. And
especially being so little and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, it worked both ways, where it's like, because they were so young, they didn't understand where I was, why I was there, or what the kind of wider thing was. However, they also didn't understand why I had to leave, and you couldn't explain it to them in a way that they understood.
Right.
Once I was confirmed that I'd be out on December 17th, I was able to tell my eldest daughter that I'm working for Santa. And once I'm done making the toys, I'll be home for December. And then I'll be able to, you know, stay home from that point on. But Laura did a fantastic job of kind of keeping me alive in the family home. She had a big poster printed near the bed of me, so the girls always saw me every night and everything. But yeah, just seeing them, and especially those first 10 months of Violet's life, seeing her grow over that period. But yes, yeah, some of those goodbyes, especially with Catherine, which is so rough.
I bet.
And basically just having to kind of push her away and be like, I've got to go through this door now, and you can't explain it to her. Yeah.
It's a tough one. It is, no doubt about it. So when you were released on license, was that scary? Did they ship you over there? Did you drive yourself? How does this work?
Well, normally people are released under their own reconnaissance and given the money for a bus or a train ticket, and basically said, you know, make sure you show up today, you know, at the very latest. I was given a police escort from Hull Prison to the approved premises.
Was this far away? Was this far from your family? I mean, you don't have to get specific, because I don't
want it was like 15 minutes from family, so it was perfect for that. I got lucky because I had to be kept in a high security hostel, and I think the next nearest one other than this one was in the northeast and would have meant a 2-hour journey.
Oh damn.
And they had me stuck with a midday check-in as well, so I could get out at 6 a.m. but I had to be back for 1 p.m. to sign in, to sign my name, and then I'd be allowed to go again. But it basically stopped us having like a proper family day out. But if something had happened and I had to go to that one up in the northeast 2 hours away, it would have basically meant I'd be traveling for 2 hours, see the kids for an hour, then back, and then back down, and then see the kids for an hour. Then
yeah,
thankfully, as it was, all my time outside of the curfew, I spent at home with the kids. So, you know, I'd be there at 6:15, you know, sometimes before they'd even wake up, but I'd be raring to go. And then, you know, we just have to keep planning the day around me having to disappear at 1 o'clock every day, which, you know, a bit of a pain. But generally, it's just, I mean, the amount of restrictions they had me on, I basically just shut down my life for those 8 months, you know.
Did they, this particular hostel that you're in, does it have guards? Does it have one guy there? How does it work?
No, there's like
how
a staff
nice
room.
Is it? Is it a large house? Is it a dungeon?
It's not. I mean, if you've ever stayed in, I mean, I don't know what the equivalent would be over there.
I guess you have your own room there.
S Western or something. But yeah, you have your own room. And the equivalent here is in the UK is like a, what are they called now? Travel lodge. You know,
so
pretty
like
basic
hotel,
clean, nice. Yeah,
that's not bad.
And I mean, huge improvement on prison. Jesus, I felt like luxury, you know, to go back to an actual mattress rather than just a kind of sheet of plastic on top of harder plastic. I felt really, really pleased to be back to that. And then you have got relative freedom. You know, there's a lounge downstairs, a pool table, there's an Xbox and everything. But I just didn't spend any time there. You know, I came back from a curfew and basically the last possible minute, you know, just maximizing time with the family. But like I say, it's like with the restrictions, I couldn't talk to anyone within PA. I couldn't use the internet. I couldn't, I basically had to inform counterterrorism of absolutely everything I did, any new relationships. So if I'd taken the kids to the playground and made friends with another one of the dads there, I'd be expected to provide name and date of birth for counterterrorism to do a background check on them. It was just, I know James Allchurch, Sven Longshanks, he got out before me. And I think basically his license restrictions were really lax. And as soon as he got out, he was back to podcasting. And I think maybe they learned a lesson from that, that they need to keep us shut down. And I know James Costello is another one who's just recently got out. And I don't doubt that he's probably on the same, if not stricter, license restrictions than I was, to really either, I think they either want us forgotten about by the end of our time or for us to be broken. Thankfully, you know, I had Laura who, you know, I mean, she's deputy leader of PA, so, you know, can't talk to anyone in PA, and it's like I'm married to the deputy leader, so I'm still pretty plugged in as to what was going on.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, even getting a job, you know, I do interior wall insulation at the moment, and it's they were really concerned that I could be working inside a building that someone else could be living in, again, because of the risk of radicalization. Huh. You know, as if I'm like taking a break from the tools just to radicalize someone.
Sam's so a professional white man. He's going to radicalize the universe.
Yeah. So it's like I had to, you know, just promise. It's like, no, everyone, everywhere I work, everyone's moved out. Don't worry about it. It's like, geez. And had to tell him exactly which houses I was working on, ankle tag, you know, GPS trace and all that.
They had the ankle tag on you?
Yeah, that came off on, I think it was 9 a.m. on the last day of my license.
Okay, so so basically, did you know you were going to be moved and released on into license? Did you know you were going to be released ahead of time? Or is it like
I knew I was going to be released. The approved premises thing, I only heard about that from other prisoners. And they were like, oh, don't worry about it, mate. You do like 4 weeks. I mean, the fact that you've got a house and family to go back to, you'll be in there like 2 weeks. Don't worry about it. Because, you know, most of these guys come out. They ain't got a job. They ain't got anywhere to go. So, you know, it takes time for the council to find housing for them. But they were like, yeah, with you, it'll be 2-3 weeks tops. And then eventually I got the official word from my probation team that it's like, yeah, kind of minimum 6 months, maximum 12. And like all these other prisoners who are in for, you know, drugs, and, you know, beating their wife half to death and everything. They're like, what? 6 months? I've never heard that. And yeah, it's like I was in that approved premises for 2 weeks and I was like the guy who'd been there the longest because there was such a high turnover of people. And then like the midday check-in, you know, most guys, they dropped it after a week. It's like I had that midday check-in for 5 months.
Now do they clean your room? Is it like a hotel? Do they feed you 2 times a day? How does this place work?
No, they handle the cleaning of the sheets, but your room is you're expected to clean it yourself, which is, you know, fair dues, and that's part of the agreement of being there. Like if you turn the place into an absolute pigsty, then they have the right to take away the bed and you'll get recalled to prison. So, you know, people have an incentive to do it themselves. Same with your cell in prison, that's all entirely on you. So yeah, I think I looked it up and it's something like the amount of people who get recalled from these hostels or over the course of the license period, it's something like 80% of people go back inside. So I was really intent on working to make sure I wasn't one of those 80. And it came close at times, you know, I mean, just silly mistakes. Like eventually I was allowed a smartphone. And at one point, I think I'd given it to Catherine. She was watching something on YouTube and unbeknownst to me, Laura had been showing me a phone number for a bank, you know, just because I needed to clear something up. She was showing me the phone number for this bank on her phone. And one of my restrictions is I can't use someone else's device to the point where it's like, if I asked you what the time was and you looked at your phone, I would have been in breach and could potentially be recalled.
Wow.
But anyway, Catherine had taken it upon herself to switch to the camera mode and had snapped a picture of Laura showing me her phone and me in the foreground, like my feet or whatever. And I didn't see it till the next day. And at this point, it was November. So it's like we were really close, and obviously Christmas was coming up, and I was thinking, it's like I was having to hand over my phone every month for like digital forensics. So they were going to find this picture, even if I deleted it, and it'd be even worse if I deleted it and I didn't tell them. So I was like, I'm going to have to tell them this picture's been taken. So I told them, and it's like they stewed on it for about 3 weeks, and they were like, this is serious. You know, Laura's shown you her phone. You know, I mean, God knows what. You could have been talking to Mark Collett on that phone for all we know all this time. And it's like, you know, and due to the gravity of your case, it wouldn't just be the usual 7-day recall to teach you a lesson. You'd be going back in for the remaining 3 months. And I was like, oh my God. And then I think I was just finishing work one day, and they called, and my probation guy was like, I was like, oh, here we go. I'm going to miss Christmas. And he goes, we're going to reinstate your curfew from home. So you have to be home from 6 p.m. until 6 a.m. And I was like, oh, cool. That'll teach me, you know. I was like, you know, God, dodged a bullet there. There's just that constant threat. And I mean, some of these guys, I mean, they come out. I mean, I think there was a crack house across the road from the hostel that I was staying at, because they'd stay there all day and then come back to the hostel and just be like absolutely catatonic, just completely stoned out of their heads. But I mean, the staff didn't seem to care. It was only if they brought drugs in that they'd actually get you in trouble. I mean, there was a time, I think I was playing the Xbox, and there were three other guys in the lounge, and all of them are just like drooling, just completely out of it. And the guy comes in doing a welfare check, basically just needs a thumbs up from you to say that you're still alive. And it's like, Damien, like that. And he's just like, and I'd like reach over and like punch him in the leg. And he's like, oh yeah, I'm all right. And the staff member's like, oh, yep, you're fine. Don't worry about that. You know, and just moves on. And it's like, what the hell? But yeah, be every couple of days, you'd have police there to rearrest someone and take them back to prison.
Did you get along really well with the guards? Did any of these guards agree with your politics, you think? They probably wouldn't say that if they did.
Some did. Yeah. There was a number of them. I think there was one point, it was the guy who ran the wing, but he called me into his office.
Which prison was this?
This was Hull. But he pulled me into his office, and he's like, I'm seeing all the mail you're getting, I'm looking at your listing here on my list of prisoners, and it says you're a conflict prisoner, which basically means that I can't be left in a room with a sex offender or something like that, because I will do damage to him. And he's like, I'm seeing this conflict thing, and normally the people with conflict are psychopaths. So he's like, why have you got it? And I was like, oh, it's because I'm a far right racist or whatever. So
racist.
Yes. And it's like, and he said, it's like, all right, well, I wouldn't say I'm not sympathetic to your views, you know. And there'd be other officers who wanted to talk to me about various things, Tommy Robinson, stuff like that. And then there's a lot of ex-military doing that job as well. And that, again, it's people who have lived life and from that kind of come out and got a very realistic view of the world. So I got along great with a lot of them. Same cannot be said for my probation team. He was this boomer shitlib, but just the most detestable personality on him. And I had to meet him every week. And every week it was an hour or 2 hours of just like the worst kind of Twitter debates. You know, the kind of stuff you remember from like Blood Sports days, where it's like, there's just, the conversation is just nonsense because neither of you are willing to give an inch. And it's like to the point where he's going, I don't believe indigenous people exist. And you're just like, what? You know, like, no, they do exist. You're just supposed to deny that to white people. You know, you're not just supposed to say none of them exist, you know. And then he's like, you know, anyone can take any land that they want. And I was just like, this, you know, absolutely mental. But he was just so emotionally invested, and we knew this from the get-go, because I think the first email exchange I had with him, he said, like, the difference between you and me is I love multiculturalism, and I don't believe that anyone has any more right than anyone else to a place as their homeland because of some accident of birth. And it's like from that point, I was like, this guy is just he's off on one.
It's amazing that only white people believe that, though.
I know.
That alone, I mean, only the fact that only white people will sit on something. This is what I used to say. Will sit on like the opposing views forum on Stormfront, arguing with other white people on whether or not there's such a thing as white people. The fact that only whites do that should tell them everything. We can't find another group that does that.
Yeah. I know. It's it feels like now as well, it's like these conversations have just been had so many times that it's like for them to still being hashed out, I've got to question like the motivations of anyone who's still arguing these things. You know, I mean, here in England, we've just had a recent kind of spat where we're having to argue that the English people are an ethnicity. And there's people just openly, you know, pointing out like black people with British citizenship and being like, just as English as you. And you're just like, come on. It can't be 2026 and we're still having this argument. You know, it feels like you're just trying to drag me down into this quagmire to waste my time. you know, and then hopefully eventually when the clock runs out, you know, we're a minority and you've won. But yeah, it's dealing with him was just absolutely horrendous. Every week, dude. Every week. And because of the power dynamic, it's like normally someone like that, you'd ridicule them, you'd ignore them at most. And it's like, instead, I'm forced to have a conversation with someone like that. You know, there's no block button. I can't walk out. I've just got to.
You can't just answer every question as yes or no, or like you already know my answer. Can you?
Well, if you tried that, then he would accuse you of malicious compliance, and basically say it's like you've got to engage me in order to fulfill your requirements of the license. So it's like at times I've tried different tactics, whether it be just agree with him and just be like yeah, you know, and he just dig and it'd be, it's like, you've got to answer me. It's like, tell me more about this. And I'd be like, I got nothing.
Sounds like he really liked this conversation. He liked this like power trip over you.
Oh god, yeah, he really loved it. And I took great pleasure in like the last time we met, and he went to shake my hand on like the last meeting. And I said, so I'm not shaking your hand. I don't have to pretend to be amenable with you anymore. I think you're disgusting. And walked away. And at that point, there was nothing he could do. But it's like, up until that point, it was just like, my freedom was in his hands. And he wouldn't really have to put much justification.
It's interesting that he wanted to shake hands with you.
Yeah, well, I think it was part of kind of, you know, it's like, oh, we've crossed swords, and it's like you know, it's been an honorable fight or a healthy debate, and it's like, no, you just have the worst arguments, and you're just a horrible person. You know, it's like the grooming gang stuff. It's like, while I'm watching on, you know, BBC News them saying like, yes, it's predominantly Pakistani men or whatever, he's telling me to my face, I don't believe you. And I'm like, I'm not making it up, you know. And you know, you tell them like what's happened to these girls, and it's like, well, they're not credible witnesses, you know. And it's like, fucking, all right, dude, you know, it's it really is. You ever heard Morgoth's definitions? There's the abomination, which is basically like a liberal who just really just revels in all the pain that comes to white people.
Yeah.
And he would alternate between one of those and a hatchling, you know, where he pretends like, oh, I don't know how the world works, you know, and I've never heard of this before. And you're like, all right, dude, I mean, I can't have a conversation with you if I'm having, I mean, the amount of times I had to explain per capita to him was just like, I think I've got an email from him somewhere where I've literally said, like, we can't move forward unless you understand per capita. And he's like, I don't see why you don't think I understand it. And I'm like, you don't understand it because whenever I bring it up, you're like, what? Yeah, he was infuriating, and I was glad to see the back of him. But he's one of those as well. Like, he lives in York, you know, which is like 98% white still in the UK. You know, and it's like, all right, well, you know, come live Bradford or something like that. And
yeah, I mean, if you're living in somewhere that's 98% white, and the only thing you watch is like mainstream news in the UK, then maybe you're not even aware of the demographics. Could be that big of a disconnect, I guess.
Oh, good, yeah. Yeah, I don't doubt it. Yeah. But
you would think someone would know about London by now. But now, there was an article, the most recent article I could find on you, interesting enough, was from Searchlight. Now, I don't like, obviously, Searchlight, and I wouldn't take them seriously, but I don't know. I don't even know if it's – I wouldn't put like photoshopping above them. But it says, meet Rupert Lowe's latest recruit. I doubt you're a recruit. You're just probably someone that signed up to support the
Yeah, just signed up. I think they launched about a day.
A Nazi jailbird. Linked to a terror group. Oh, my God. These guys, it's just, you would think they'd stop doing things that are so over the top and crazy, but they can't. They're just, they get paid to do that. So, okay. So tell me what you think about Rupert Lowe and what's going on.
I mean, it feels like the first time I'm going to be able to, hopefully, vote for a political party in the coming general election that I won't have to hold my nose to do so. I think I've got it written in my diary, published soon. But I've got it written where it's like, right, reform are going to be the vehicle, and this was back in, 2024 or something. And then to come out now and find that basically the Tory party has done like a kind of weird face change, like T-1000 reassembled into the reform. It's just kind of like, oh my God, it's like, this is beyond even having to hold my nose. If I had to vote for them, it'd just be a complete betrayal of everything that I stand for. And Restore Britain, they came out and straight off the blocks, it was Millions Must Go. The British are an ethnicity or an ethnic grouping. And Rupert Lowe himself, he comes across as really genuine. He doesn't have the nefarious history of trying to destroy every far right party the UK's had, like Farage does. Yeah. And then he seems to have a young, quite dynamic team around him as well. I signed up to join, and I wanted to be there to support it in some way, because demographically, if we don't turn this thing around in 2029, we are cooked.
How's his party doing? I know he's got record numbers as far as for a new party.
Yeah, I think he's just taken over in terms of membership numbers. I think he's just overtaken the Lib Dems, which is like the kind of de facto third party here in the UK.
What's that? Is he above 110,000 yet?
112, I think. I got an email from him today saying they're around 112.
How many members do you think he could get? Do you think he'd get 200,000, 300,000?
Well, I mean, it's never been a reflection of votes.
Right.
Like the largest parties have come in at like 160,000 members, and then they've, romped to, I think Labour, 160,000, and then, they've romped to victory on a landslide majority. So the membership's never reflective of vote. But I mean, if you've got 112 people, 112,000 people, and then a fraction of those,
it is a reflection of money.
Getting active. Well, yeah, exactly that. Yeah. And it's like, that's something that has been sorely lacking within the kind of right wing sphere, is any sort of real funding,
100,000.
Tommy Robinson's been hoovering up all the funds,
Does Tommy Robinson support Rupert Lowe now or no?
He has, however, he didn't at first, and I think the tactic originally was to take him down, and then when that didn't work, I think now the tactic is to try and co-opt and basically try and bring Rupert Lowe to Tommy, with the promise of like, I've got the support, I hold the biggest rallies and everything, if you want this behind you, you want to kind of get in line. But it seems to be constantly, they're just kind of, because they were all behind Advance, which is like headed up by like a half Pakistani, half English guy. But then Advance lost their, completely spilled their spaghetti when Lowe was just like, it's like, yeah, you can join us, but you're not getting a seat at the top table. And they were like, oh, but, you know, scumbags and everything. But yeah, the kind of Zionist right is trying to get their tendrils in to restore. And I'm hoping the kind of younger, like I say, with that kind of young dynamic crowd around him, I'm hoping they've got the advice to him that it's like,
what is Tommy toxic.
What is Rupert's opinion of the Iran war? Because, I mean, Trump has, like, told the UK, which, if you're young in the UK, you should thank God that Trump said, we don't want you in our war. Which are like, yeah, thank God, because, you know, Keir Starmer is going to jump in there fighting for Israel. So, you know, thank God knows who to die.
Lowe's Restore was the only party who said we shouldn't be going in. Reform and, you know, Richard Kiss the Wall ties were all in for it. You know, get boots on the ground. We should be, you know, helping
boots
our
on the
Israeli
ground. And I'm crazy.
Yeah, I mean, Reform was at that kind of point when it first started. They've since U-turned when it became very clear that the, what did they say, 3-day special operation has now dragged on for like 2-3 weeks.
It's looking dicey to me.
Yeah. So it's they've since U-turned because basically everyone was kind of like, are you retarded? We're not doing
anything. What's his opinion on putting boots on the ground against Russia? What's his view of Russia?
I mean, to be honest, the Ukraine war hasn't been a political bellwether here in the UK. It's been something that's been going on, and we've been funding the Ukraine side.
Yeah.
But in terms of, there's been no expectation really of politicians jumping on one side or the other. There's been a lot of virtue signaling, but especially on the right wing side.
It's cost the British taxpayers a lot of money, and I know there's always like, mm-hmm. We shouldn't be sending money to that.
And it's just been kind of like the, you know, the solidarity with Ukraine and everything, but it was only the Iran thing. Like when they were trying to ferment the kind of color revolution a few weeks back over in Iran, Farage was like doing the arms around the Iranian diaspora at their like demonstrations in London outside the embassy and being like, we love the free Iranians and, you know, the despots over there need to fall and everything like that. And it was kind of like, dude, this is pretty on the nose to be doing this. you know, clearly someone's yanked your Zionist leash there and brought you to heel. But yeah, Restore haven't made any. I think the worst thing people have been able to put on Restore is from like 2 years ago. There's a tweet. This was when Rupert Lowe was a part of Reform. There's a tweet where he's like, oh, we should stand with our allies in Israel. But it's like, well, if he was an MP for Reform, it's like, well, you kind of got to stick to the party line, haven't you? And then also, I appreciate that people can, you know, develop over time. And 2 years has been a long time for Israel in this kind of epoch that we're in now. I can see people who had previously been supportive of them learning a lot and seeing a lot and hearing a lot over the last 2 years and being like, no, we're not doing this again, you know?
Intriguing. So basically, Rupert Lowe is about the only guy that you like. And, I mean, there's not a really election coming for quite a while. So it's going to be quite a ride from here to there, right? Mm-hmm. Sub-local elections, maybe.
Yeah, we've got 3 years, so in like 2029. But like I say, it's like this really is a kind of last chance saloon kind of thing. I think white British births are below 50% now. So, you know, demographics being destiny, we don't come back from this. And it's like, unless we start to turn things around in 2029, then we're talking another 5 years of white boomers dying off, of younger non-whites reaching voting age, and just the numbers just don't add up. So all these other parties, you know, we have a bunch of smaller parties here in the UK, you know, talking about 20 years to power, you know, well, we'll start off with local elections and then we'll move our way up and everything. And it's like 20 years, we're done. You know, there's no way you're winning a general election in 20 years. It's just numerically, you're not going to do it. So there's no point even starting down that path. The thing with Restore is it's like, right, you're jumping in at a point basically like 10, 15 years into the plan of most of these other parties. You've got an MP, you've got a national party, you've got 112,000 members. And it's like, well, why wouldn't you it's basically like putting in a cheat code, you know, at the last possible moment. And it's like, great. All right, cool. We can take a step forward here. And it'll be interesting to see going forward. It's like, well, will he pull from the support of, you know, people like me and Steve Laws and, you know, Mark Pollitt even, you know, will he come out and disavow that kind of those people, or will he basically just allow, as a lot of the left-wing groups do, allow your radicals to work in the periphery?
How old is he?
Open up space for you. I think he's, God, he's going to be getting on now. Is he 60-something?
Okay.
Actually, I don't know.
He's
like,
in his 60s. You know, that's okay.
Yeah.
I thought maybe he might be older, but that's okay.
Yeah, I don't know how. Yeah, what we got? Born 57.
Okay. He's in his 50s. Interesting. Okay, so he's Gen X.
He's 68.
Oh, okay, 68. All right. So he's a boomer. And basically, well, I don't know. He has some strong words, but who all supports him that is like, I remember Elon Musk, but you never know what Elon Musk is doing.
Yeah, I mean,
no one trusts anyone. But who in the British establishment is actually supporting him? Anyone?
Almost no one, which is why I think he's legit. Basically, you kind of know someone by their enemies, and he came out and immediately made enemies of the entire Zionist right here in the UK. I think there's a complete ban on any sort of reporting on him on like GB News, which is our kind of like Zionist right-wing news broadcaster. And it's like, right, yeah, I mean, that's who I want to be censored, because that is basically, it's a proof of it's legitimacy in this kind of information age. It's like, if you're not being promoted, it's like, well, you're probably doing something right, you know, as it were.
Do you think the average Brit even has a chance of hearing his message?
Oh God, yeah.
Okay, I mean, because you've got the money, and because of the fact that the country's so small. I mean, you can drive across the country. Do you think is the money will be a factor there? Because, I mean, just because someone's well known, or just because you have a political party with a couple hundred thousand, Mark Collette was telling us that that doesn't necessarily mean the average person is going to vote for them or even know who they are.
No, I think that's where a lot of the work's going to come in for members of the branches and everything. I mean, social media is huge, but I mean, they're doing like man on the street interviews, and you know, people who you would think would be a very low information voter, you know, the kind of pie and chips British guy who's on the beach on Benidorm, you wouldn't think that's someone who's, you know, politically keyed in, but he's going like, I like that Rupert Lowe, you know, and it's like, all right, cool. So it's like somehow he's hearing about him, you know. It's
all right, so you're finding that a lot of people that you normally wouldn't think would be engaged enough to even know who this is, because he's kind of like, you know, these micro parties come out, they really percolate for, sometimes they have some mini celebrities in it and whatnot, and people know who they are. But this guy's totally different bill of goods when it comes to penetration into that demographic that he would be need to vote for him, because he's obviously not gonna get the Muslim vote.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we've seen with, you know, whether it's companies or brands or whatever, but it's like organic social media spread is something that they treat like gold. And I think that's what Rupert's enjoyed over the last few weeks. If we can keep that going, fantastic. And then, you know, if you can turn these members, you know, clearly people are very energized by this. If you can turn that into leaflets through doors, you know, canvassing, things like that, I don't see why he couldn't be propelled.
You would think out of 110,000,
you'd hope so. Yeah,
eventually probably going to have 150,000. I would imagine. You think you might have 5% that are radical enough to really do that? That would be a big number. You start talking about 5,000 people in the UK handing out.
Yeah, and I mean, the big thing's going to be, obviously, come 2029. It's not a vote for one person. You know, it's MPs in all these seats, and it's finding people who are going to be able to.
Is Reform's polling going down or up?
It's going down.
It is on
a downward trend. Yeah.
Okay. Because the concern was Mark was that the concern with Mark and everyone else, he was just going to split up votes.
It's kind of like splitting the vote between what? Because it's like Reform are literally the Tories who welcomed in the Boris wave. And it's like, well, I mean, if that's the vote we've got to split, then it's like, well, I don't think that was ever the same vote. I know it wasn't my vote, you know, that wasn't the vote that I was kind of weighing up between the two. It's like, basically, I was just going to sit that one out. I wasn't going to be choosing Reform, especially now.
You think he could bring out people that wouldn't normally vote, like Donald Trump originally did and stuff like that?
I mean, you've got to look at prior to Restore forming a party, it's like the entire online right was basically like, civil war. You know, it's like there's no political way out at all. And then he announced Restore, and all of a sudden people were like, right, 2029, that's our deadline. We've got to make a change by then. Whether that translates to real world action, I'd like it to. But having been a political organizer for Patriotic Alternative now for 5 years, it's people talk a big game online, but then all you have to do is arrange a trip down the pub and, you know, ghost town. There's no one there, you know, let alone leafleting or banner drops or anything. It's normally a very committed core. So it'll be interesting to see with Restore whether the committed core is a lot larger. I've seen some pictures from local branch meetings, and they seem well attended, which when I've attended local branch meetings of kind of right-wing parties here in the UK before, it's been, you know, one man and his dog. Here you've got, you know, 50 people in a local branch meeting, and it's like, brilliant. Again, if that can transform into actual real-world political action, then we stand a chance.
Have you been to, you might not want to say, but have you been to any Restore events at all? Have you met this guy?
No.
I don't know if you would.
I think there's a branch supposed to be opening locally.
Okay.
I'll be, you know, waiting to hear about it.
Well, how do you join the party? Do you just join? Do you have to send in money?
Go online. I think it's £20.
Okay.
Easiest £20 I ever spent. Okay. In order to, he's to get
money.
In the loop.
He's raising money just off people going.
Yeah, I mean, what's that? What's 112,000 times 20? That's, you're looking over.
Can you give more, or that's the standard fee?
You can give more. Yeah, I think there is some limit to how much you can give a political party. I can't remember what it is here in the UK. But, yeah.
Well, it's
a couple million pounds.
That's more than that.
I mean, we had some, I think when they first launched, they had some attention from, like, there's kind of people, like in the UK equivalent of Shark Tank, we call it Dragon's Den, but there's one of the investors, he's called Duncan Bannatyne, he owns a bunch of gyms and stuff like that, but, you know, absolutely minted. But he said, like, we should talk, you know, and it's like, all right, cool. So potentially there's some big investors there as well. I think the kind of trajectory Britain's on, I think even if you're very business-minded, it's like, well, getting rid of the British people doesn't speak to good business. It speaks to, you know, a million and one vape shops and fried chicken shops and just a general collapse. So if you're in the business of high-end gyms, it's not Pakistanis going there. It's, you know, it's white gym bunnies and stuff like that, you know. So it's like, just business wise, it makes sense to get involved with Restore, and I think that's something with Lowe as well. Being 68, he's not ideological. I think he's someone who's very rational and sees the state of the country, the trajectory it's on, and goes, "All right, something needs to be done about this because it's going down the absolute tubes."
Yeah, he
I don't think he's there going like, "Sorry,
go ahead." No, finish. I'm sorry.
But yeah, it's like, it's not like he, you know, he's like, it's like, I've read my Mosley or, you know, I idolize Enoch Powell or anything like that. I think he said his hero is like Cromwell.
That's what I was going to say. Cromwell isn't exactly timid. He's pretty friggin' radical.
Yeah.
As far as his solutions. Well, his solutions are a little bit more radical. Some of the most radical in British history, his solutions.
Yeah.
So I think that's intriguing.
That's what it's going to take.
kind of interesting. Cromwell.
It is.
Yeah. He's got a Cromwell club that's
It'll be interesting to see where it develops, but at the moment it seems to be a complete kind of Zionist attack upon Restore from every quarter. So it's like, right, these are the right people who I want to be upset with me. And it's just whether he can weather that storm and not allow it to make him bend, as it does with so many others, you know, when they come out apologizing for anything. You know, stick to the line, millions must go. You know, no more foreign wars, you know. But, I mean, it's the thing is, we're not asking for much. You know, we literally just want to carry on existing. And for so many of these people, that's just beyond the pale. And it's like, all right then, well, you know, if that's the line we have to draw, then we'll gladly fight on that line, you know.
Okay, let me cover the super chat. Tim, hi, Sam. Hi, Tim. Hi, Sam. Thanks. Cheers to you, Laura, and your children. Go PA. Thank you very much, Mr. Pac-Man, over there. I do appreciate it. What is there anything you want to promote, Sam? Is there anything? I got you on for another few minutes here.
Yeah, I kept a diary while I was inside, detailing the kind of crazy kind of stuff that happens in prison, and it's almost daily occurrence that something absolutely wild would happen. And so the kind of first half is that, and then the second half is a lot of it's dealing with probation and the kind of arguments that they'd present and the back and forth we'd have and everything. And then also it covers the trial. So I've called it Legal, Truthful, Guilty.
Is this one, a book? Is it a book?
On camera, yes. Sorry. But we are about ready to publish come 24th of March. I wasn't allowed on my computer, but somehow I managed to type this up purely by force of will of my mind. But I'll be releasing that. And it's called Legal, Truthful, Guilty because the case summary described my stickers as extreme but lawful. And then the prosecution at the start of the opening of the trial, he cautioned the jury that it's like to disregard whether the stickers are true or not because the truth is no defense in court. And obviously on the cover, but one less sticker. I put one less sticker out there. That's exactly what the 100-handed stickers look like. There was never a number 000. So that's that sticker.
Very cool.
But yeah, it's, you know, I've had a few people read through it and they've been highly entertained by it. So pre-orders are available now at grammartowlers.co.uk.
Let me pull up Grammar Towlers. Let me see here. I haven't put it up. Let me see this. And you guys can follow him on.
I'm on Twitter as well. Real Sam Melia, I think I'm under.
I'll show that. That's in the description, guys. You can get his X in the description. Forgot to have this up. You guys can go here. The link is in all the descriptions here and on Odyssey. You can go here. It is Real Sam Melia on x.com. And link is in the description. And Grandma Towers, you can just look it up. Grandma Towers, it's in the DuckDuckGo search engine. So I guess it's everywhere else, I would think. Maybe not Google, but very nice.
Yeah, and
oh, wow, recipe of the month. Okay.
All right, that's so a bit out of date, that page.
We've got teas and we got coffee. Are you a coffee drinker or tea drinker?
None. I'm a coffee guy. Yeah. Okay. Laura's tea.
Yeah, I'm a coffee guy too.
She loves the stuff. Yeah, you got the About Us page where you can see all the overt racism that we engage in.
Guys, very nice. And you're going to sell the book on here. Oh, here we go.
Yeah, it will be available on Amazon, but obviously.
Ebook and paper book?
Okay. Yeah, nice. Like the tea and coffee sales is how we basically scratch out a living in order to engage in our political work. So
you got to think of some angle when you start getting tossed in jail and big news articles written up because you ain't getting a normal job becomes very, very difficult and people become afraid.
Mm-hmm. The pre-order is available there, both the ebook and paperback. And that obviously provides the largest profit margin. It will be available on Amazon, but obviously they, you know, SOC takes their cut, doesn't it?
I don't know anything about selling books. I imagine you're better off if you've had to learn that much on your own to go the extra mile. And that's fantastic. and you guys can go there and buy tea. And hold on, let me. I'm going to put the link up in all the different chats so these guys can. Like, I forgot that, and I will have put this up on the website as well. I will put a link to Grandma Tyler's.
Yeah, we ship worldwide as well.
So, oh, okay, that's you know, good. Wherever it's you not are, in the UK guys, and they do have recipes on there. They're saying the women in the chat are saying they got recipes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a recipe book, which was actually compiled. I think people from the PA community submitted kind of family recipes and stuff. So we've got the Grandma Tyler's recipe book there, which was compiled, and Laura did so much work on that because everyone who submits a recipe has a different way of measuring things. So she had to standardize all the, but
women.
There's a few copies of that left, but to be honest, the guy who prints it, I'm gonna order some more off him because.
Oh, okay, here we go. Cakes and Bakes recipe book.
Mm-hmm.
Is Laura a good baker?
Fantastic. She's really improved since I've been away, actually. I might go away again. She might come back as a little gastro. But now she makes her own bread, and she's on like a ultra-processed food kick at the moment, so like avoiding anything that features chemicals.
Yeah, you need to talk to your friend Mark Collette about his energy drinking habit and his quarter pounder with cheese habit.
Yeah, so it's like, yeah, we get what is it, the kids call it family bread, but it's
what is Laura's family bread, what is that?
It's Laura's homemade bread.
Okay
but they'll be it's like, what's a family bread?
Is it like a sourdough or something? Or
yeah, she does a fantastic sourdough, but sourdough seems to be like a whole day affair. Like, you've got to let rise for 6 hours, and she's got this starter that we got from a friend of ours who does a lot of
They've had starters. Some of these places, these bakeries over here, have had starters for decades on end.
Mm. Yeah, and it's impressive. I think when she was handed the starter, it was like a little tiny cup of the stuff, and now she's got like a mason jar that's got like three quarters full.
Growing bacteria.
She'll be going in there, like putting flour and sugar in there. It's like, I'm just feeding it. And I was like, what, is it alive? And it's like, yeah, it eats this stuff up and it grows. And then I skim a bit off the top and make a sourdough with it. I'm like, cool.
Pretty funny.
Cool.
But, well, I appreciate you coming on, Sam, and being a good sport. And
it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, mate.
Yeah. Thanks for serving time on behalf of white people.
Yeah, we got to push that conversation forward somehow.
On behalf of the sticker community and the meme community.
The adhesive collective.
You can laugh now. Yeah. He's walking around free. But do you guys have anything coming up for PA that you want to promote?
Or? Yeah, we've got a big demo coming up on the 28th of March in Nuneaton, which is in the Midlands. But I'll be speaking there as well.
Cool.
And then tomorrow... it's only a small thing, but we're having a little welcome back dinner for me. So there's about 20 or so of us who will be going out, but get involved with the PA community because, you know, whether Restore rises or falls, what's going to be really important in the coming years is a cohesive community. People you can rely on who you know think similarly to you, and you can lean on them and help each other out. And that's what PA is there for, you know, whether it's the camps, the conferences, or just friends. I mean, I think I went to lunch with someone on Monday because I found him on Twitter, and turns out we're only 10 minutes away from each other, and it's like, brilliant, made that connection. He's coming to this dinner on Saturday, you know. It's like, this is how it kind of starts. And yeah, no matter what's coming, community is going to be really important. So yeah, get involved.
Yeah, we have to rebuild everything from the ground up, and that's like all of Western civilization, especially the English speaking world. But everyone else is in the same boat. Some countries are maybe more white than others, but you know what I mean. But okay, thank you very much for coming on, guys. I'll be back Sunday 5:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and his Twitter link is in the description, and you can go to his Twitter, and you can actually. I noticed that it has Grandma Tyler's on it, so you should be good to go. Even if you're not logged into X, you'll be able to grab that link and go over there and buy. You can't buy scones or anything like that, but you can buy everything else, and recipes to make them and the whole nine yards, and they deserve your support for sure. And I do appreciate you coming on, Sam, and being a good sport.
I appreciate the promotion. Thank you so much.
Cheers, guys. I'll be back on Sunday.